to Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and CWF Legends Fan Fest. A new mystery guest has joined us. That joke courtesy of Chris Spiker. I thought it was pretty funny. CWF Legends Fan Fest, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I should say Facebook has this. I am in Facebook jail, Jeff.
No.
Yes.
Facebook. Was it the dick pics again? Did you post those again?
Well, yeah, and they're not my dicks either. That's the crazy part. But yeah, but here's the thing. So I woke up. It was last Tuesday morning. I woke up. I tried to post something, and I see that my account is restricted for 7 days. So immediately I want to know why. I demand answers from Zuckerberg, and I click, and it says you posted content which might be considered offensive to readers or whatever. And apparently I did this in 2019. So they're just catching up with me. So at this rate, I imagine that every month or so I'm going to be back in Facebook jail for shit that I posted years ago.
Could you share with us what it was that you posted?
I would love to share with you, Jeff. However, Facebook won't tell me, and I have no idea.
Nah, don't you love that? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the fuck is that, right?
You know, because I don't know if people in our group understand this or know this, but we get that sort of, oh, there was a questionable content posted, and then we'll go, okay, let me see who it was, and it'll show us who posted it. You know, Bob Smith posted something questionable, and then I tried, well, let's see what the fucker posted, and it won't let me see it. So then I have to reach out to said Bob Smith. I've done this more than a few times and said, hey, I don't know what the hell it was, but you posted something that Facebook flagged. And so that's why it got yanked. It wasn't yanked by me, but Facebook, you know. So, and you're like, I wish I could tell you what the fuck it was, you know. So I don't know. It's weird. So here on episode 182, Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and Barry, today we are going to be doing our match of the week. I have to say, Barry, bit of an upset in my opinion. I was thinking for sure that they would go for the Ted DiBiase versus Terry Gordy cage match from Houston. And then after that was over, you got the added special attraction of Ted DiBiase versus Michael Hayes, Country Whippin'. But no, and a somewhat surprising result, we are featuring the Midnight Express, Bobby and Dennis taking on Terry Taylor and Brad Armstrong. What's interesting, this is from January 1985. This was a one-off. These were a couple of Mid-South guys that went to, I believe it's Fort Worth, just for the night, wrestled there one time, and then went back to the UWF, to Mid-South, whatever. You know, of course, Terry Taylor later appeared in World Class, but I don't know that Brad Armstrong ever appeared in World Class after this, Barry.
I don't think he did. And so let me just remove that. That was one of the things I had in basically. Like, I don't remember Taylor and Armstrong ever in World Class. Taylor, I knew, was in later years after the UWF closed. But I don't remember Armstrong ever there. So I can remove that. But Jeff, you just mentioned something about this match, that it's a bit of an upset. And speaking of upsets, we've actually had quite a few upsets in the comedy tourney that we have going on in our Facebook group. Would that be correct?
That would be correct. And we may have one of the hosts of this show who's slightly angered about those upsets. I'm going to throw it to you, Bear.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
The Big Lebowski is gone. Oh, wait a minute. Before I say the Big Lebowski is gone, Barry, you should have said, of course, the fake tournament that we're posting. Because, of course, obviously, as the person that started this tournament, I have rigged the fucking tournament. Oh, you got to give me a second now, Barry, because I'm going to get on a roll here. I have rigged the fucking tournament. And, of course, since I'm rigging this fucking tournament, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my co-host favorite fucking movie of all time, and I'm going to yank it in the second fucking round. Give me a goddamn break. It's a rigged fucking tournament.
Yeah, and let me ask you a question.
I'm done.
Can you rig things even if money's not involved? Is there a purpose of doing it?
And obviously, I've set the tournament up, and now I'm the one casting all those fucking hundreds of votes, not the people in our group. It's a rigged fucking tournament.
Yeah, well, Lebowski, though, if I'm correct, and I don't remember the film, but I think Lebowski actually lost. Was it Blues Brothers?
Now you're going to have me go check, and I will for you. Right. While you continue a ranting, go ahead.
At least it lost to a decent film, but I got to tell you, I'm really surprised at some of the films, and I'm not talking from a personal perspective as far as ones that I like or dislike. Obviously, Lebowski, Fletch is on right now, and probably going to lose to another film that I don't.
Animal House. At least it lost to.
There you go. Exactly. How can we complain? Because Animal House is one of the great comedies of all time. But there have been some upsets, and some of them really surprise me. And my gut tells me a lot of it is generational. That you've got, you know, we've got some younger listeners. When I say younger, in their mid 30s, that grew up during the era and probably saw these movies as they were 12 and 13 year old kids. And of course that's going to resonate and that's going to build a memory that's going to stick with them for life. But, you know, from my perspective, there have been some great movies. Slapshot is, you know, that right there, I think that's one of the top 5 to 10 comedies in the history of film. And who did that lose to? Who did Slapshot lose
it
to?
It lost to Naked Gun.
Okay. Enough said.
Well, here's the thing. Let me just say this. Have there been upsets? And now, let me say, when I first came up with the concept of this tournament, this is the sort of thing that I almost wanted to happen. Because sure. I thought the fact that you had two really funny movies matched up with one another that didn't make it to the finals. Because, you know, it's like what I used was the old Howard Baum thing about every fucking classic rock tournament always ends up with Stairway to Heaven winning the tournament. Okay. But if you match that up against a really good song in the second or third round, what would happen if Stairway to Heaven lost to a really good classic rock song? Okay. So using that idea, that doesn't mean Howard Baum gets credit for the tournament, by the way. But if you
well, have, Howard's going to take it though.
Of course. Yes. Naturally. Okay. Yeah. So, but if you have like Animal House facing off with the Big Lebowski, okay, what happens then? These are two movies that you might've thought could have made it much further in the tournament, but let's talk about the fact not only that it lost, but that it lost by a rather substantial margin. That's what really surprised me, Barry. I mean, like, you know, it lost by, I'm trying to find out, it lost by almost 100 votes. That's what's crazy. It's not that it lost. If it had lost by, you know, 10 votes or something like that, I'd have been like, ah, it was a tough matchup and Lebowski, you know, lost. And the only thing that I would say about your argument for the generational thing is, you know, we had stuff like Ghostbusters taking on Me, Myself, and Irene, which is a movie that's 20 years old as opposed to one that's, you know, almost going on 40 years. Ghostbusters won rather handily, you know, so and Blues Brothers and Stripes, those are two older movies. That was a tough contest where Blues Brothers won by 10 votes, you know, so that was a very tough contest. I love both those movies. You know, that's a tournament contest where I sit there and say, you know, I really don't care who wins that matchup, because either way, there's going to be a movie I really like that's going to, you know, disappointingly fall, but something I really like is going to move forward. Now, I'm going to put something out there that maybe I haven't made clear. There are movies in this tournament, for those of you who think this is a fake tournament, I put movies in here that I'm not necessarily a huge fan of, because I know that there are movies that, as Barry said, younger people who listen to this show, maybe I'll give you a perfect example. We talked about it before we started recording, Office Space. Okay. According to Lou and Barry, this is some kind of iconic fucking movie to people. I watched it, got 30 minutes in and turned it off because I just didn't understand what the big deal was. Yes. And I know that's going to come as a stunner, you know, and Lou said it's really something that people who worked in the tech field really identify with. And I get that. And I worked in an office for 30 fucking years, but it was in the court system. Okay. So maybe that's why I didn't get it, but I understand that it's an iconic, funny movie to a lot of people, which is why I put it in the tournament. Could I have been a douchebag like I usually am and said, no, I'm only putting in movies that I like? No, I reached out to people. What's a movie that, hey, wasn't mentioned that maybe that we could include in the first round of the tournament? I did that. Did I do it to every single fucking person in the group? No. I did it to people that are part of this show, that are part of our Facebook group and, you know, are active in the group. So I did that. So I included movies that, you know, here we go. Tommy Boy. Okay. I like Tommy Boy. I think Chris Farley is really funny. Did I think Tommy Boy is one of the funniest fucking movies of all time? No, but I can see where people like Tommy Boy. It lost to Blazing Saddles. Guess what? It should have lost to Blazing Saddles. Okay. Newsflash for all of you wondering. So anyway, the tournament moves on. I think it's a lot of fun. For those of you who think it's fake, don't vote. If you think I've worked the whole thing, don't fucking vote. And also, let's not even get into the people. It's going to start another rant, Barry. The go people who say, I've lost faith in the group if this movie loses. Shit happens, people. Shit happens. And that's why the Big Lebowski lost. That's why people, you know, Barry and I, the first, and this came up in the group today, the very first movie we ever talked about on the very first episode of this broadcast, this Peabody Award-winning podcast, first time I said that today, Barry, was Easy Money by Rodney Dangerfield. And Easy Money lost. I'd have loved to see Easy Money go to the finals because I think it's a fucking hilarious movie. Somebody in the group said, well, it's just not Rodney's, you know, funniest movie. Okay.
It is. But,
yes, I know that's his opinion. And I get that. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with it, but that's his opinion. Okay. And if that's the way he feels, that's fine. Rodney's still got another movie that's in the tournament. And, you know, we'll see how far that movie goes. But anyway, okay. So anything else to talk about with the tournament, Barry?
What is that, Back to School? Is that Rodney's movie that's still in the tournament?
Yeah, the one where he's the soccer coach didn't make the, what was it, the
Ladybugs.
I was gonna say that. Yeah,
yeah. You know, we've still never had on Lily Hayden. I know I was trying to get her.
That's right. Yes,
anniversary show, but I will reach out.
Remind the folks who that is.
Yeah, first I have to remind myself, but she played Rodney,
the violin player.
She's a vibe, but she played Rodney's youngest daughter in the film, Jennifer Jason Leigh, the older daughter who got married. But she became a, I guess, a violin, but world-renowned violin player, and actually does scores for movies even. So we reached out to her months ago for the big anniversary show, our third anniversary show, and she said, contact me in a few weeks because I'm finishing up a score, but I would love to come on the show and discuss it. So I'm going to reach back out and I'll tell her about this tournament and what happened to Easy Money. God damn it.
It's never a bad time to talk about Rodney. I think that's something that's everyone can agree on. So let's talk about some other stuff. I got to be honest with you, this show, because I was out of town on vacation, it's going to be all over the map. We're going to be talking about a lot of different things.
I think it's going to be a good show, though. Yeah. tells me based, we have a winner right star, here. Right? So, yeah. So
let's talk about, Barry, real quick. Let me tell you about my trip to Nashville that we spent the long weekend in Nashville with our good friends Jim and Mona. You met at my daughter's wedding. Good people, and it's always good to see them. So here's a couple things that I did not know until I got to Nashville, Barry, that I was speaking to you and Sweet Lou about before we started recording. Apparently, Nashville, Tennessee is the bachelorette party of the United States. Now, I don't know whether out in Vegas they do those kind of things. So maybe let me just say, like, the eastern part of the United States, that's the go-to place for bachelorette parties, because Barry, here was a city, and as far as I understand, it's like really just very recently opened up again after the pandemic and stuff like that, because somebody told us that literally 2 weeks ago, the town was dead. And we went there this weekend. There is a, have you ever been to Nashville, by the way?
I have. Yep.
Okay. So are you familiar, or do you remember the part of Nashville downtown where there's the street it's Broadway?
I do. Yes.
Okay. Broadway, for the those who do not realize it or do not know, is the part of Nashville where they have all the honky tonk bars, all the saloons, all the watering holes, whatever you want to call them, that have live music. Okay. And there are different kinds of places. I want to say it's about a 75-25 blend where you got country and Western or some sort of, you know, honky tonk type of stuff. Then there are a couple other bars where they play like classic rock, blues, jazz, that kind of stuff. But it's about 75% country and Western, which, not surprisingly, considering that Nashville is like the home of country music, according to what people hear and say.
So, Jeff, let me ask you a question. Right. What's the difference? And when you say country Western, you know what I think of automatically?
Country and Western.
We play both types, country and Western. Yeah,
Bob's Country Bunker was not located on the Broadway side of town.
What's the difference between country and Western?
Well, here again, this is something that I've said on the show before. I like older country music. I like country music from like the 70s. I like country music into the early to mid 80s. And then some point, and it's funny because my wife and I took a trip to the Country Music Hall of Fame, which you really don't have to be a huge mark for country music to enjoy it and understand the history and stuff like that. But I can tell you, when I started getting into the 90s, I was like, yeah, it didn't appeal to me. Now, I know people that fucking love that shit and can't get enough of it. But I tell you, one thing you really notice is, you know, it's called country and Western because a lot of the music started off with people from the country. Okay. But now it is so, it's like comparing wrestling, what wrestling was in the 70s and 80s, to what wrestling is now, the corporate influence, the homogenized sort of feel to it. And that's sort of like what country and Western is to me, at least. Now it's a very homogenized version, you know, of what it was in the early days. And, you know, we also took time to go to the Johnny Cash Museum, which I was really interested in because I like Johnny Cash's music. Oh, yeah. And that was good stuff. And a really interesting story about Johnny and all his, you know, he was so gifted. And here's a story that I don't know if you know about, Barry. Are you familiar with the story about Johnny's first wife?
Oh, I saw the film. I saw the documentary.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Her name is Vivian.
Yes.
Oh, so yeah.
Vivian, apparently, after they'd been married a couple years, they had a few kids. Someone came out and said, your wife is black. And so apparently they did some sort of research. And I don't think it was her mom, but I think her grandmother was like half black or something like that. So immediately, now you have to understand, this was like late 50s, early 60s. There's a stigma that was attached to that point because it to the way people looked at it, it was like, oh, he's married to a black woman. Please. She was like 125. I can't do the math, Barry. 124th, one, like, you know, it was so ridiculous. Okay. So what ends up happening is his wife divorces him, not because of that, but because of the
fact
that
he was yeah. with June Carter Cash. That's why his
actually, I believe that was later. I mean, I could be wrong, but
according to the documentary, it wasn't.
But besides that, he had the drinking problem. I think he was into drugs and stuff like that. Yep. And so, you know, that let's put it this way. The museum didn't say he was committing adultery and that's why his wife left him.
Using drugs and committing adultery, right? Yeah.
So anyway, so she leaves him. And so, and then of course he hooks up with June Carter and stuff like that. And he stays married to her for the rest of his life. Okay. Yeah. And by all accounts, she got him out of his alcohol and drug situations and stuff like that. But anyway, I had not seen the documentary you're talking about. So it was news to me and stuff that I didn't hear about. And I thought it was a pretty interesting story. So getting back to the Broadway. So Broadway, where all the, you know, the bars are and stuff like that has had this renaissance literally within the last 2 weeks of people that are coming out. Let's just say, Barry, there was not a lot of social distancing going on in Nashville this weekend. I told my wife, I said, if we somehow make it out of this weekend without getting COVID, we are never going to get COVID because these people are, let's put it this way. For those of you from Florida, you'll understand this reference. It's a little like spring break was in the mid 80s in Fort Lauderdale. Just batshit crazy with people all over the place. And there are lots of bachelorette parties going on where there are hot looking. I mean, Barry, oh man, are there hot looking women in Nashville, and they are drunk and horny as fuck. And it is crazy. And I told my wife, if I wasn't married and I was in my late 20s, I would move to Nashville and get a job as a server or a bartender or something. Because holy shit, are there a lot of women there? And it's just a crazy, you know, that they have the deals where they, you know, besides the bars, they also have these giant, like old army trucks. And they have the parties in the old army truck. And what you do is you have to furnish the booze. So if you bring a couple cases of beer, if you bring a couple of bottles of vodka, rum, whiskey, your bourbon, whatever, and you bring it, and they essentially have a DJ playing in the back of the truck. And it's like, you know, maybe 15, 20 people, and they're whooping it up, and the car is driving them around, and they wave to everybody, and they're dancing, having a good old time and getting drunker and shit. And it's just fucking crazy. I can't even begin to explain it. Like I said, think of Fort Lauderdale in the mid 80s before they started instituting all the municipal ordinances about drinking on the beach and drinking out in public and stuff like that. It is fucking crazy, Barry.
Sheriff Nick Navarro.
So, that's right.
Yes. Right? Sheriff Nick. So spring break, if you've ever seen the movies, and certainly there's a lot of photographs that are out there, it was almost body on top of body because there was just no room to move. You're talking about a million kids converging on a relatively small space, and in turn bringing millions and millions of dollars to South Florida and the economy, and especially for Lauderdale. And then Sheriff Nick, in his infinite wisdom, decided somewhere around the mid to late 80s that they no longer wanted spring breakers in Fort Lauderdale. And they essentially closed everything down. And it was a one of the worst moves I think you could have possibly, from a business perspective, ever made. Of course, their justification was lower crime. You're not going to have, you know, the rowdiness and all the bullshit that takes place with spring break. At the same time, you're losing $100 million, whatever the figure is. So absolutely crazy. Vivian, though, Jeff, so I watched this documentary, and I want to say I saw it on Netflix. It's either Netflix or Prime, and I think it's called My Name is Vivian.
Yes. And getting back to Johnny Cash's wife, just to
getting back to Johnny Cash's wife. She was stunningly beautiful. Does she look black? She looks really exotic. It's hard to say if she's I think she looks like she's from like Sicily, which, you know, I know there's African roots in parts of Italy and Sicily. But she's just very exotic looking, a beautiful, strikingly beautiful woman. But the story, at least from the documentary, goes that I believe they had 3 to 4 young daughters.
Yeah, I think Roseanne Cash was one of them, maybe. Yep. Yeah,
absolutely. And she was a good wife. Again, it's her documentary, so they are painting one side of it. But Johnny got into drugs and alcohol and then took up with June Carter Cash and wound up leaving her. And apparently, again, according to the documentary, she never recovered. And even though she got married again, she loved Johnny up until her dying days. And it's a very sad documentary, you know, very interesting, too, but very sad. But if anybody who's a fan of Johnny Cash, 100%, you got to see this.
Yeah, it's his museum is one of so we end up.
We love to see that, Jeff.
Yeah.
That's like a dream. Yeah.
We went to the Johnny Cash Museum. We went to the obviously the Country and Western Museum. With the history of country Western music. And then we went to, which was the highlight of the tour for me, was the Museum of, now I can't even think of it. What was it, like the American Music or American Musicians Hall of Fame or something like that. And what's great about this is that you don't realize, you know, you pick out, and here's the argument that I used, or not the argument, but the example that I use, okay? This is a really old school example. Dionne Warwick, okay? Or even somebody that's like a singer, like, you know, like a Carrie Underwood or a Mariah Carey or something like that. Somebody that doesn't have, you know, it's not like a band, okay? It's not Aerosmith or the Beatles or something like that. It's an individual singer. You do not realize the amount of people behind the scenes, the musicians, the managers, the publicists, the backing band, the president of the music company, all the people that play a role in getting that music made and then getting it put out to the audience. And as you go through this, you know, you realize that there were places in the country, you know, Muscle Shoals is famous for it. The Sun Records, all the people they had, you know, and the guys that ended up becoming Elvis's band and, you know, people like that, that are behind the scenes that don't get like all this kind of recognition. And a lot of times when you watch one of these, you know, the Grammys or the, what do they call it? The American Music Awards. And if they do a tribute sometimes, you'll see like, oh, this guy passed away. You know, you're sitting there thinking, who the hell is that guy? And you do a Google on his name and you find out, oh, he was a studio musician in Muscle Shoals for like 30 years. And he was part of the, you know, like 25 albums or something like that. You're like, holy shit. And that really gives you an appreciation for it. And even somebody, I'll throw it out there. I know Brian Last used to work for Sony, you know, and he had a job at Sony. And that's part of what they do at Sony Music is, you know, there are all these different people behind the scenes that are playing a part in getting these records and music out there to the audience, you know. And it was really fascinating seeing all the things that go on behind the scenes. And the other thing that was interesting, they literally in this particular Hall of Fame or museum, they covered every single kind of music you can even imagine. Everything from metal, country and Western, pop music, rap, everything. And I think the fact that they went out and made a point of including every single kind of music, I think really adds to the museum. It was really cool. And it's actually very in the old Nashville Auditorium, Flaring Steamboat, May of 1989. That's where they now have this museum. And if you go to Nashville, completely worth it. And, picture posted in the group and then realized I made a nice little error. I don't know if you saw that last night, but I was under the impression that the PYTs versus Tommy Rich and Eddie Gilbert match that was in my top 100 of the 80s took place in Nashville. I was very thoughtfully reminded maybe it was Memphis. And I went, oh, shit, that's right. It was. So a couple other things let me talk about. So let me ask you, Barry, if you've ever had somebody like this that you know. I'm going to mention my friend Mona, a dear, dear friend of mine from high school. She's going to listen to this and go, oh my God, they're going to talk about me now. Barry, have you ever been in a car with somebody that does this? The person that if you're driving and they're on, you know, the passenger seat or in the back seat, feels the need as you're going by every single location, every business, to say the name of the business. Ah, there's a McDonald's. Ah, Bob Smith Dentistry. And that's Mona in the car. And we called her out on it. She's like, I didn't realize I was doing that. And her husband goes, oh yeah, she does that all the time. It was hilarious.
That's
and
funny.
So, yeah, it was really funny. So do you know anybody that does that? My mom does that. That's why I asked.
No, but now that you have pointed this out, I am going to do this anytime in the car with somebody to see what kind of reaction I'm going to get. So I love it. I'm going to do it. Zoe and I are actually driving to Boston in 48 hours, and I'm going to see how long I can do that before she starts hitting me. So
before she starts going, Dad, shut up.
Exactly. So, oh, that's funny, though. I like that.
So let's go now, Harry. To our match of the week, we are going to, I believe it's Fort Worth, because it's not the Sportatorium. It is January, I want to say it, January 14th, 1985 in Fort Worth. I'm not sure that's the exact date, because I think in Jim Cornette's scrapbook, there may be a different date, and I'm going to go by Jim's memory more than Google, I got to be honest with you. But suffice to say, it's January of 1985. It is the Midnight Express, who have just started in the territory. And they are working with Terry Taylor and Brad Armstrong, who, as we mentioned at the top of the show, strictly a one-shot deal where they're appearing. And I got to tell you, this is a really, really good match. I will say one of my favorite parts of the whole match is when Terry Taylor is coming in the ring and Mark Lawrence, who's on the call of the match. And Mark Lawrence is one of those guilty pleasures in the same way that Vince McMahon as an announcer was a guilty pleasure with me, because Mark Lawrence will just start talking about stuff that has nothing to do with the match, you know. And so he starts talking about how much the young ladies at ringside are apparently appreciating a young Terry Taylor, Barry.
Yeah. I like that a lot too. Yeah, he says it too. He's right out there and says it, and he says something to the effect too that Jim Cornette thinks it's all about him, but it's really Terry Taylor. And I thought that was good. The ring announcer though, was that Ralph Pulley?
I think wasn't it the older guy?
Yeah, I always got Ralph Pulley and the other guy.
No, Ralph Pulley was the younger guy. This was the older guy.
Okay, you're right.
And didn't
Joe,
he
Joe
didn't
somebody here?
Yeah, it's not Joe McHugh, but he reminds me of Joe McHugh, the old WWF announcer.
Yeah, the guy, he's absolutely terrible, though. He, first off, doesn't have a voice to be doing that. Secondly, refers to Jim Cornette as Jim Conrad. And then he quickly corrects himself and calls him Cornette. But then he introduces Loverboy Dennis Conroy and does that twice, the beginning and the end of the match.
Because Jim Cornette corrects him and he goes, I was going to say that.
Yeah. He's horrific. How would you think you're not going to get a good match though?
Yeah.
With these four guys. So you do, you have a solid match. What I liked about it, I like to finish a lot, and this is a 2 out of 3 falls match. Midnight wins the first fall. Babyfaces win the second fall, but I love the ending, and they do. What was that move called? The finish on the for the final fall.
I don't know if they had a name for it yet.
I love that. And it's a double team maneuver, but it's a clean win. And they gave him a clean win over Terry Taylor. And I'll tell you something else. Terry Taylor, here's a guy that I've had a lot of opinions on over the last 35 or 40 years. And I'll go through some of those opinions right now. I was going to say fortune, but it was more misfortune. So I met Terry Taylor once and I thought he was a complete dick. And I'm going to speak my mind on this one. And he's got a reputation. I don't know if it's current. I think this is going back to the old days, but he had a reputation of being a dick. And he was a guy that was massively in love with himself. But he also, I was at a fan convention in 1980 in Atlanta. It was the WFIA convention, and Terry Taylor was there. And Terry Taylor at this stage was maybe a year or 2 years out of the gate. So he was still essentially green, still a rookie. And he was hanging outside of the dressing rooms, and a group of us went over and said, "Oh, Mr. Taylor, can we get your autograph? We're with the Wrestling Fans International Association." And he looked at us and he said, "Not unless you grow a pair of tits." And I always thought that was interesting. And he was serious. That was, you know, it wasn't just a funny line. He was actually serious about it. But his attitude followed him the rest of his career. And I mean, there's a lot of stories out there of why he was made the Red Rooster, or why Dusty always buried him. That's a great story. But he really was kind of a douche. But if you look at this match, he reminds me of somebody, and it's Shawn Michaels. And there's this mannerism that Taylor has that I think I've seen Shawn Michaels do. And obviously, I've spoken about Shawn Michaels before and his attitude.
I believe the word was hell of a worker, huge douchebag.
Yeah, that was it. That was pretty much it, which is true. Look, there's not more came out after the fact about what a douchebag he was at CAC. I think just, you know, a month or two after we actually recorded that episode. And, but Taylor's a guy. You know, as I watched this match, that's all I saw really was I saw Taylor, and I saw a guy that should have been a much bigger star than he was. And I think his personality and the fact that he was a douchebag kind of really held him back. And he could be a great guy now for all I know. I have no idea. But Shawn Michaels obviously was very bright, very political. And even though he was a huge douchebag, still talented in the ring, absolutely. But he was a guy that was able to ascend to these big heights where Taylor never did. And I think Taylor, when you look back at his career, and that's an, you know, you're going to ask a question later on, Jeff. And
that he's the perfect answer to.
Yeah. And I didn't even think about that ahead of time. And now I'm like going, fuck, there's the guy. But here's a guy that did it to himself.
Yeah.
Here's a guy that absolutely did it to himself.
No, what I was going to say was I will discuss Terry Taylor more with a question that I posed to a few people and that we will talk about. But let me say, I had I was fortunate enough, as part of our South Florida dinners, Terry Taylor joined us, and he was a very good guest. He was very entertaining and stuff like that, told some great stories. There was a point, though, where that sort of douchebaggery, if you will, reared its head. I asked him a question that I've always wondered, and I guess the only person that will answer this question is if we ever get Bill Watts on this show. I said, okay, so May of 1986, the Universal Wrestling Federation has become a new corporation. They've left behind the quote unquote Mid-South area to become the UWF. So they have this tournament in Houston, Texas, and it comes down to Terry Gordy and Jim Duggan. I said, so why the fuck wasn't Bill Watts there? He's the president of the damn company. It's the biggest tournament in the history of your organization. And Bill is not there because, of course, there's the famous incident where during a brawl outside the ring, I think it was One Man Gang, maybe posted Jim Duggan. I could be wrong. Maybe it was Gordy. And Duggan hit the ring post, but his head hit one of the screws or bolts that are outside the post. He got a humongous gash. I mean, I remember that footage, and it was just like, fuck me. And so I asked Terry, I said, I couldn't believe that Bill wasn't there. Why wasn't he there? And he goes, I don't fucking know. Why don't you ask him? You know, why don't you ask him yourself? And it was just like, oh, okay. Thank you. And, you know,
because motherfucker, we're paying you to sit at a table in a restaurant where it's $75 a person. You can answer the fucking question.
And if he didn't know, all he had to say was, you know, that's a good question, but I don't know. You'd probably have to ask Bill that. But the way he couched it just kind of come off a little bit asshole-ish. And as you said, certainly he was a guy, and maybe it was a case of where he was a guy that was good, but wasn't quite as good as he thought he was, you know, and trust me, there's lots of those guys in wrestling, okay? Shawn Michaels could afford to be a douchebag to people because, number one, he was a great talent in the ring. And number two, Vince McMahon loved him. You combine those two things, and guess what? You get away with a lot of shit. You know, you get away with Shawn, what was it, losing his smile. Not everybody's going to get away with – Terry Taylor is not going to get away with, I'm sorry, Bill, I lost my smile. Bill Watts is going to say, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Go fuck yourself and work for somebody else. You know, Shawn Michaels got away with that because the two things I mentioned. So we're going to get back to Terry Taylor in a second. So as far as the question I'll ask later in the podcast. So any other thoughts about the match? You said, very solid match. Yeah.
Very solid. Yeah.
Interesting to me because this was not, this was not Midnight versus Rock and Roll or something like that. This was a team, the Midnight Express, really, although I'm sure they worked against different teams, different variations of Terry Taylor and somebody or Brad Armstrong and somebody, but those two guys together. And it made me wonder, the Fantastics, when they got brought into World Class, of course, they worked with the Midnight Express and stuff like that. And it always made me wonder, and this is a question I would, I don't know if Jim Cornette's ever answered this question on his experience or not, but I would have loved to have seen what could have happened from a financial aspect if the Midnight Express had been brought into World Class and they programmed them with Kevin Carey. I think that would have been, real money, especially if they would have let them be the Dirty Tricks squad that everybody knew they were, that Memphis style. Could Kevin and Carey have adjusted their, let's be honest, rather stiff style that they were known for? And they had a great feud with Gino and Chris. There's no question about that. But I always wondered what would have happened if Midnight and the Von Erichs had been in a feud. I think that would have been just absolute money in the bank. Bear, what about you?
Yeah, it would have been too. And I remember when they the Midnight Express first showed up on WCCW, and it was we would get it down in South Florida on Channel 45 or one of the, I forget exact, Channel 33.
33.
Yeah, 45 was religious TV, right?
I'm not sure that you would ever be familiar with the channel.
No. Just as I was breezing by it, I saw that.
Exactly.
But I think it was 33. And they never seemed like the perfect fit for that territory, which was bizarre. But yeah, that would have been a great feud. The Midnight Express were that good. And look, truthfully, I don't know how often Brad Armstrong and Terry Taylor ever teamed, but they were actually pretty good together.
Oh, well. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so anyway, before we move on, I just recalled something, Barry, going back to Nashville. One of the things that's, when you see old friends and stuff, a lot of times stories that you've told elsewhere, they're new to these people. And so I started telling Jim and Mona a story about something that had happened to me many years ago. And I realized I'd never told this story on the show, but I think it's a pretty funny story. Barry, off the air, have I ever told you the story about the time that my family, when I say my family, I mean my wife and I, my sister, I don't recall if her husband was still alive or not. And my brother and his wife at the time, joined my parents in Charleston. Have I ever told you that story?
I don't think so.
Okay. So we go to Charleston, little family get together. I want to say this is mid 2000s. Okay. And so, by the way, Charleston is a fantastic city to visit, not only for the historical aspect, great food city, Barry. And I know that you're all about that, which, by the way, reminds me of something else I got to talk about Nashville. The food there, unbelievable. So we're in Charleston. We go out and we had dinner and stuff like that. And so we're coming back to the hotel and it's 10 o'clock, 10:30, something like that. And so my parents are going in for the night. And so my sister says, why don't we go out and find a nice club, listen to some live music, something like that. Oh, fine. We're all good with that. So we went to go up to the hotel, the attendant at the front desk. And so we ask if there's any good bars or clubs around where we can listen to some live music. And my sister says, specifically, is there any good place where we can listen to some blues music? And so the person says, well, not too far down the street, there's this bar. And I want to say the name of the bar was something like Big Mama's or something like that. And so we go up. And of course, any good blues bar, it's got to be a little bit divey. Am I correct? You don't want to go to a sterile, it's like you go into a bookstore. If you're going to a used bookstore, you want to smell the books. You don't want to walk into a sterile, they just put the new books out. No, you want to smell the musk of the old books and stuff. And so you go into a blues bar. So you want to see the chairs, little tears in the chair, that kind of stuff. And so we go in and the lady at the front counter, $5 cover charge, $10 cover charge, whatever. So we pay that. She says, yeah, the band's going to be coming on in about 20, 25 minutes. And so we ordered some drinks. We're sitting around talking. So then after, about 20, 25 minutes, the band starts slowly congregating on the stage. Okay. The guitarist comes up and he's sort of, tuning his guitar. And then the drummer comes up and he's doing the, the things. And then the piano player goes up or whatever. And so then, as they're sitting there, so it's time to start the show. And so they start playing like an instrumental number. Okay. And it's just like, you know, the Blues Brothers, where the guy says, ladies and gentlemen, now it's time for our feature attraction, you know? And so, so the guy is introducing, he says, ladies and gentlemen, now it's time for our featured performer. We would like everyone to put their hands together for Big Mama Blues. It was at that point, Barry, that the lady that had taken our tickets at the front counter starts working her way up to the stage.
There you go.
She was a multitasker. And so she goes up on the stage and she starts singing. And I don't know what she sang the first song was. But so then the second number that she sang, Barry, you are an appreciative of the great Bob Seger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So Bob Seger's song, of course, The Fire Down Below.
Sure.
Okay, yes. So she starts singing Bob Seger's song, The Fire Down Below. Except, and mind you, Big Mama Blues, I'm going to say early to mid-50s, okay? Yeah, this is not some 25 years old with the hot jeans and stuff. No, this is mid to low 50s. And so as she's singing the song, Bear, she gets to the point of the song. She goes, they got the fire down below. Except when she would do that, she would take both her hands, and much like a DX, she would point at the vajayjay and say, nice. I got the fire down below. And so we're all kind of at the table looking at one another going, a little bit uncomfortable. Okay. But, you know, whatever. So then after that song's over, it's time to introduce the band. Okay. Okay, over here on, you know, like piano, we've got, or not, it wasn't piano, maybe it was bass. We've got Bob Smith, my husband, Bob Smith. Okay, and everyone's like, yeah, and he's like, you know, acknowledging the crowd and stuff like that. And then it's our drummer, you know, whatever, and she introduces him, everybody acknowledges it. So then she says, and now let me introduce our lead guitarist is Jimmy Smith, my son.
Wow.
And I said, this poor kid has to watch his mom on a nightly basis talk about how she's got the fire down below and point to the vajayjay.
So was that is that the original message of the song? I'd have never paid attention. I know the song.
I don't know, but it was Big Mama's message. That's all I got to say.
Wow. Big Mama taking tickets at the door and pointing to the vajayjay. Nice.
She was a multitasker.
Yes. Dream woman right there. Absolutely.
Let's not forget, she still has the fire down below. I don't know if she still does or not, but, you know. So anyway, I neglected to mention, Barry, let's talk, just because I know you're a food guy. Let's talk about the food in Nashville. So the very first day we're there, shout out to my friend Chris Lyell, I believe it's pronounced, who met us at Hattie B's Hot Chicken. Nashville, for those who don't realize it, has some sort of pop culture thing going on where they're all about the hot chicken. And essentially it's like you take a chicken breast with the skin on it. And I believe it's dipped in some sort of sauce, which is it's really a lot like buffalo sauce. Like if you have it on wings or something like that, but I tried it. I was very impressed. It was like had a nice bite to it, but it wasn't like, holy shit, give me something to put the fire out, you know, but had a nice bite to it. You can get it where it's like nuclear if you want. I don't know if you're like that kind of guy, Barry, but, they also have good sides. My wife had the potato salad. She said, Barry, best potato salad she's ever had in her life.
Wow.
So Hattie B's and Chris Lyell, we get a strong recommendation. We do appreciate it. And not only that, Barry, as I mentioned to you, Chris took care of the chick. Boom. Yes, we are very appreciative of that here at Breaking KB with Bowden and Barry. If we don't appreciate anything, it's someone else picking up the check. So shout out to Chris and thank you for that, my man. After that, Barry, we had a chance to go to a couple different places. Let's see. We had some barbecue. I know what we did. We went out to a place called Puckett's, which is near the downtown district. I had shrimp and grits. So, Barry, are you a shrimp and grits fan, my man?
Absolutely. Is this named after Kirby Puckett also?
It could be. Right. And so do I. I am a huge fan of that. But here's what they did a little different. And when I tell you, you're going to go, but I'm telling you, it fucking worked. They take the shrimp and grits. And of course, they have like, you know, peppers and stuff like that in with the grits. But then on top of the shrimp and grits, Barry, just a drizzle, not a lot, but a drizzle barbecue sauce.
Wow. I can see that working. Yeah.
Was amazing. So if you go to Nashville, definitely the place you got to go to besides Hattie B's, or there's a place called Prince's, which apparently is the originator of the hot chicken, but apparently the original owners no longer own Prince's. That's at least what Chris told me. So either Hattie B's or Prince's for hot chicken. and then go to Puckett's and get the shrimp and grits, my man. Oh my God, it is fucking amazing.
Chris, knowing the history of restaurants in Nashville, which I appreciate too, shrimp and grits is a great thing, Jeff. The best I ever had is in a, it was a fish camp in Florence, South Carolina.
Really? And
I was driving from Pennsylvania down to Florida with the family, and we pulled up reviews and we were looking for the best restaurant in Florence, and this was voted the top restaurant. And the best part, you could sit outside. It wasn't fancy. So we had Ozzy with us, so we all sat outside, but the shrimp and grits was absolutely incredible. I love the idea, though, of the barbecue sauce, because shrimp and grits can be a little mellow. You know, it's not a crazy flavorful dish. The grits usually get a little cheese with the grits. The shrimp could be, but you put a little barbecue, you get that tang. I like the contrast of flavors there a lot.
Yeah, no, as I said, the best meal that we've had there, giving to the hot chicken, which was also excellent. And I will tell you one thing, Barry, because I was thinking about you, my man. We were running a little bit late one night, and so we were just looking. And of course, because the place has just reopened, the downtown area for all the bachelorette parties and all the other assorted shenanigans going on. Usually, any good restaurant, you're going to wait 30 to 45 minutes to get in because it's just a madhouse.
Right.
So we found a diner a couple blocks off, and it sort of had an upscale diner look to it. And we went in, and I got a burger, and there was nothing wrong with the burger. The burger was fine. The server, Barry, wow, was he bad. He was so bad that the manager came over to deliver food, and I said, I didn't have any problem with your food at all, but your server completely fucking abandoned us. And, I hate to screw somebody on a tip because I know how hard they work. And, it was like a $30 check and we gave him $5 or something, but, so we didn't completely stiff him, but I said, this guy needs to step up to the plate, man. He's losing it. So before you tell me what you would have taken, how you would have handled that as a manager of a restaurant, as opposed to a server. So the guy had the dreads. Okay. The white guy with the dreads. Okay. And he had a scarf, the top of the forehead, but the dreads are hanging out the back. So as a restaurant manager, the second question I have, besides how you would handle that situation, what are the rules vis-a-vis the laws? My wife would say that, like my brother used to work at IHOP when he was a teenager, okay? And he had to wear the hairnet because he had his hair a little bit long. What are the rules as far as being a server when you have hair that's long like that?
Well, there's no federally mandated law that's going to tell you, but most restaurants, and why don't we take like Cheesecake Factory as an example? So you have a chain restaurant, you've got 100, 200, 300 locations nationally. Everybody knows the Cheesecake Factory. They are going to have standards. And, for me, it isn't that I care if somebody has dreads, long hair, a beard or something, as long as it's neatly maintained. The same token, you don't want to find a large dread hair in your food.
Of course not. Yeah.
Right. But you also, it's like common sense with the deodorant and antiperspirant. You don't want somebody who smells serving your food either. Yeah. And let me just briefly say, I had to have a conversation with a guy once. This was probably 20 years ago, and it was in New York City, and he was from another country. I want to say he was from Albania, and he was a busboy, and he reeked. I mean, it was to the point if you were within 4 feet of him, you smelled him. Now, when you're in
a Seinfeld reference, smelly car.
Smelly car. But yeah. in a restaurant where you're eating food, smelling, the busboy's BO is not really ideal. But it made it uncomfortable for me because, A, he was about 15 years older than I was, and he had been a neuroscientist in Albania. So I had to go tell a neuroscientist that he smelled and he needed to put on deodorant. And I got to tell you, that was really uncomfortable.
Would Gordon Ramsay have handled that?
Gordon would have laid it out. God bless Gordon. I was like fucking, I was looking down at the ground, like covering my face. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, oh, I hate to have to, I felt terrible. Now I would just tell somebody no problem. But back then I had an issue with it. If you've got a beard, if you've got long hair, it should be contained in some form.
Yeah.
So how do you,
This isn't a rant where everyone who has long hair can't be a server. No, not at all.
Just the opposite.
But look, what I'm saying is he had the top of the head with the scarf and stuff like that. But, you know, maybe like a ponytail or something, you know, like put it in a ponytail or something. Just like if you have a guy with a beard, you know, ZZ Top is your waiter. You know, you don't want one of those guys fucking having their beard dragging in your food, right? You know, like tie it off or something so you don't have that.
Yeah,
so
and there's a good chance, too, that, and I'm not familiar with Nashville or as far as the laws or the state of Tennessee, but there's a great chance that that the hair does have to be secured and covered in some form. So he probably was breaking a law, but that's not his issue. That's on management, because if management is not doing what they're supposed to be doing, which, quote unquote, is managing a restaurant, then, you know, the guy could come waving his dick around. And if nobody gives a shit, he's going to go ahead and do it. So the first part of it, so it comes down to two things for me. Was, and this is also where I could lay a lot of this on management, was he inattentive because he was maybe busy either trying to chat up ladies or guys, or was he on his phone, or was he just bullshitting, or was he just not trained and just ill-prepared for the job? Because there really are, you know, there's many different types of bad service. But if he was ineffectual because he clearly didn't give a shit, then I would, you know, to me, it, you know, people make excuses. And look, I was in the restaurant business for my entire fucking life. I've seen good, I've seen bad, I've made plenty of mistakes. But at the same time, you know, if somebody goes into a restaurant, especially coming off of the economy, off of the pandemic that we've had for the last year, money's tight. It's like, I've got a lot of fucking money these days where I can go spend it. But a lot of people are like that. So if I go to a restaurant and I'm going to put down $60 or $100, whatever that is, I have a right. I have an expectation that my service is going to be adequate. I'm not asking you to go head and shoulders and above. I don't need you to entertain me. I just want fast, friendly, and efficient food. So if he clearly didn't give a shit, you have every right to be upset because you're a paying customer. On the other hand, if he just wasn't a good waiter because he was never trained properly, that again rests head and shoulders on the shoulders of management.
Absolutely.
It's not doing anything right. So
So what we said to the manager, and I will say on the guy's behalf, he did have a table that he was also the server of that had, I think, maybe 6 or 8 people sitting at it. And, you know, so if he's busy with that table because of the amount of work that that table will require, then he should, you know, I think it's either on him or the manager to say, okay, he's spending a lot of time. I'm spending a lot of time with this table. Hey, so-and-so, can you help me out by making sure that table's okay?
100%. You know, Jeff, you are 100% correct.
Check. So, by the way, let me just say, Barry, that we love our listeners in Wales.
John Lee's going to say, I'm in England. I'm not in Wales.
But Wales, why are they mentioning Wales? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But Jeff, to that point, though, again, it's you know, look, I've been in restaurants where you can see. So a server, let's say he's got 4 tables. He's got a 4-top, 2 deuces, then he's got a party of 10. So he's got a large party. If he can't make it over to your table, the least he can do is say, I'm so sorry, I've got to take this order at this large party, but I'll be right over. If he can't do that, then management needs to say, hey, I apologize, your server's tied up with this large table. Is there a beverage that I can get you? Can I get you something to start off? Something like that. It's hospitality. Yeah. At the end of the day, look, if I wanted to eat, I will cook food here for myself. I'll go to a drive-thru. I'll go to fucking Shake Shack. But if I want an experience where I'm sitting down at a restaurant, I do want the experience of dining in a restaurant, you know?
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, when we get our food, there was an error on one of either Mona or Jim's plate that, you know, the manager had to correct. So, you know, you had that. And so, again, giving the guy the benefit of the doubt, it could have been that maybe he wasn't trained properly. So what we did was, again, we didn't stiff the guy and say, fuck him, we're not giving him a tip. I don't believe in doing that. But I'm also not going to give the guy 30% and say you did a fabulous job. No. So I, you know, gave him the tip and I told the manager, I said, your guy was lacking, man. He needs to step up a little bit because, you know, I don't know if he was busy with other tables, but he was not up to the standards that you would expect as a customer in a place that specializes in hospitality. And that's a real good point that you made.
So, and I told this story, I think, on really one of the first five episodes we did. But this is something that just fucking irritated me beyond all end. And you got to realize, too, when you go out to eat, your server views you as a mark. This is going to be a really good analogy here, because when you go out to eat, your server doesn't look at somebody who possibly might have been in the restaurant business. They're viewing you, quote unquote, as a mark. And my wife and I think we were dating at the time. We went to an Italian restaurant in Greenwich Village, New York, and our table was literally right next to the bar, 4 feet separate from the bar. So we ordered a bottle of wine. Our server took our order, friendly enough guy, went up to the bar to get the bottle of wine, and then proceeded to have a 5-minute conversation about his plans.
Yes,
for the weekend.
I remember you telling me this.
I was fucking livid. I'm like, we're 4 feet fucking away from you. Drop off the wine and go back to. He didn't do it. I was so mad. That right there is complete indifference, though, and not giving a shit. Because he was, I think he was a fine waiter otherwise. I think mechanically and operationally, he knew what to do. But he also just, you know, had an attitude about it. So it is tough. And it's, you know, again, I go to Shake Shack and I might spend $20, you know, me and Zoe, $20. It's a quality product, but I'm ordering at a counter. If I sit down at a table, especially now where I think I've eaten in a restaurant and ordered at a sit down restaurant only twice in the last year because of the pandemic, it's almost an event for me at this stage. It's a big fucking deal if I'm doing that. So again, you know, if I'm going to spend $75 or $100, show me some hospitality.
Yeah, that's not too much to ask. So.
No.
So Barry, you have something you want to throw at me, I understand.
I do. Jeff, I have several things that I'm going to throw at you. So put on your catcher's mask, get the old mitt out, and prepare. So I... It being a bachelor now, and I got to say to my wife, who I still refer to as my wife, because I don't believe I'll be dating anybody that's listening to us currently.
not currently,
but hey, down the road, you never know. But my wife and my daughter are out of town this week, and they'll be back on Wednesday, and Zoe and I will be going to Boston. But I watched some TV, and we also had some rain here. So I spent time watching TV. And one of the things I watched the other night was Coming to America. And this is Coming to America, which is the second one. And there's been some good reviews, some less than good reviews, and a lot of mediocre reviews. And that's kind of where I would go with it. I didn't like it. I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it. And it really wasn't good. But Jeff, let me break kayfabe and let me be controversial right here. Sure. I always thought the original Coming to America was kind of okay.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm going to get some again.
Oh, yeah. You think I'm going to get shit for Office Space? Okay,
oh, no.
Buddy.
I'm going to get a lot of fucking hate for this one. I've tried to like it, and it's not a bad movie, and there's a lot of good things about it, but I don't think it's hysterically funny. I think there are moments in the film that can be very funny, but I think the overall tone of it, I don't know. I think Eddie Murphy.
Are you a fan of Eddie Murphy?
I'm a fan of a lot. I should say I'm a fan of the early Eddie Murphy films.
Okay.
But he's also done some good stuff in his later years, but it got me thinking. I know that a lot of people think that his best film, a lot of our listeners, they think that his best film is Coming to America. So I said, okay, in my head, does it make the top five? And it does make the top five at number five. But that means that I've got four films that I think are funnier and better than Coming to America. So I've got a little list, Jeff. I did not prepare you ahead of time for this.
Oh,
so
am I.
So I'll go first, and then you can tell me what you think. So in order of what I think are his five best films, Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, and I think those two can flip and flop. I think, you know, if you ask me in 6 months, I might say Trading Places is funnier. But as of now, Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, 48 Hours, Bowfinger, which is a fucking sleeper if you've never seen it.
And admittedly, Bowfinger probably belonged in the tournament. That's a very funny movie.
Oh, that's a hysterical movie. Steve Martin is great, but Eddie Murphy is great. And then I would put Coming to America at number five. But I got to tell you, Dolomite, which I think you saw Dolomite as well.
Very funny movie.
And less funny at times, but a really good movie. And Eddie Murphy and Shrek. And I didn't include it only because it's an animated film. But those are it. So Jeff, if you had to, and I realize this type of question takes a lot of thought, but what would be your top five Eddie Murphy films?
So I don't have a problem with anything that you listed there. I will say that while there are some very funny movies, Eddie Murphy also had a run where he was making some really shitty movies, like,
absolutely,
you know, just trying to cash that paycheck. Hey, God bless him. You know, there are other guys that do that too. You did not mention, I thought he was very funny in Tower Heist, where he plays the guy that Ben Stiller knew when he was younger, and he basically bonds him out of jail. And, and he helps Ben Stiller steal this money from Alan Alda. It's not like one of these drop dead, I'm pissing myself laughing, but it's a funny movie. And it's, I would say it's based on what I've heard, it's probably way better than Coming to America. I think he has some stuff that is very good. His voice work in Shrek was amazing.
Yes.
It was like one of the highlights of the film. So I would have no problem if you absolutely did include that. So I would say, other than Tower Heist, I really don't have a problem. I know some people like the Nutty Professor movies. It's funny. He did a lot of work because he was playing a lot of different characters, but it was kind of a movie that kind of after a while it started repeating itself, I think, you know. But no, he was in 48 Hours and Trading Places. He was absolutely brilliant in those. And, you know, let's not forget his concert films, which were absolutely fucking amazing.
Yes.
And, you know, there are people that think Eddie Murphy's like one of the great comedians of all time. And I really can't sit there and say he's not, then of course, if you want to compare him to somebody, is Eddie Murphy better than Richard Pryor? I don't know if he's better. I think there's no question that he owes a lot of the comedian and the actor that was, he certainly owes a lot to Richard Pryor. I think
not to interrupt you, Jeff, but I will, but I think a lot, I think almost every comedian owes a lot to Richard Pryor.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was just merely trying to make it quantitative as what is he better? You know, that's to each person's own opinion. And, you know, whether you think Richard Pryor and, you talk about the Mount Rushmore of comedians, and I think guys like Pryor and George Carlin have to be on there. That's just my opinion. Awesome. And, you know, and then there are other guys. I saw somebody posted a picture the other day. I don't know if it was in our group or I saw it on Twitter. And I think it was like Chevy Chase, Steve Martin, Robin Williams, and I think it might have been Billy Crystal. And they said, oh, here's the Mount Rushmore of great comedians. And someone said, what are you fucking kidding? You know, like, and they said Steve Martin. Of those four guys, I think Robin Williams, just because Robin Williams was so fucking manic, and people still talk about his stand-up, and, you know, whether you liked him as a comedian, you know, or like as an actor, but his comic stylings, like especially when, you know, when he first broke out in Mork and Mindy and stuff like that, and he was just, he would get on Carson, and, you know, whether it was because of the cocaine or what, but wow, he was amazing. And what do you think of those four guys? Which one would you put? I know you love Chevy Chase's movies, but I'm talking strictly.
Yeah, but Chevy Chase is not. And I do. Yes. Look, I do. But I'm also, I can realize Billy Crystal to me is about as funny as cancer of the toenail. He is just,
which affects a lot of people. I don't mind.
Yeah. Billy Crystal, sorry. Just, I don't see it. Chevy Chase, I like his movies, but it's not like per se he's funny. Those lines that were written for him. He couldn't do stand-up, Chevy Chase. I don't think he ever has, so I would take him out. Robin Williams was funny, though. And Robin Williams, as you mentioned, it was partly pharmaceutical or partly cocaine, but he was also, clinically, he had some serious issues going on back to his childhood. Combine those two, and you've got a dynamo on stage. And Steve Martin, I think, is an underrated comedic genius. If anybody on that, I might actually lean towards Steve Martin. Billy Crystal, no way. And as much as I love Chevy Chase, no way.
Let me tell you, people that are of a certain age, and as you said earlier in the show, obviously there are people in our group that are younger than us. But I can tell you, when I was in high school, Steve Martin was the hottest comic in the whole country. He, even more so than Robin Williams. There was a shorter window, but Steve Martin, the wild and crazy guy thing, and, you know.
Yep. And the jerk.
The jerk and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
He was so big and so popular. And, you know, it's something that is cyclical in the sense that there's always that. Think about it. Sebastian Maniscalco, like 2 or 3 years ago, there was nobody in this country that was hotter than Sebastian Maniscalco. You know, just like maybe 10 years ago, was it? There was nobody that was hotter than Dane Cook.
Amy Schumer. Exactly.
The late 80s, Barry, who was hotter in this country than Andrew Dice Clay? For again, a short window. That guy was selling out fucking Madison Square Garden. Yeah.
Look at that.
It was just crazy. So, you know, that happens. And for that brief period of time, Steve Martin, before he really got into movies, and, you know, one thing, you get your guys, you know, here's another guy that I just thought, Jim Carrey for a while was extremely hot.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that happens is comedians that decide, Will Ferrell was like this too, that make, you know, that are comic actors, and they decide they want to make a drama. And they want to make that movie that's going to give them an Academy Award nomination. And it always shits the bed. And they just keep wanting to do it. And it just doesn't seem like it ever works, Bear.
Bill Murray, 1984, hottest movie star possibly out there, makes a movie called The Razor's Edge that nobody has ever seen and nobody speaks about because nobody wanted to see a serious – they wanted to see him catch ghosts. They wanted to see that kind of shit. So,
and I will say, when he made Lost in Translation, which was like a drama, you know, that, but of course, that was also 30 years after he made, you know,
exactly
The Razor's Edge and stuff like that. So,
yeah, and that was it. And he made another one too, a serious film 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Saint, I don't know, for the life of me, but it was a good film. But Jeff, some other shit that I wanted to throw at you, I re-engaged my love affair with Hulu over the past weekend as well. And I was on Hulu 5 years ago, borrowed a friend's password, and just never...
PSA on the PSS word.
Yeah, exactly. And I re-engaged this past weekend and actually signed up. And a couple of things came out of it. I watched two films I want to quickly share. One has a wrestling connection. One is called Kid 90. Have you heard of this film?
I've never heard of it.
It is a new film. It is a documentary on teen Hollywood stars. And it was basically filmed by the lovely and talented Soleil Moon Frye, who we know as Punky Effin' Brewster. And what she did was she carried around a video recorder wherever she went while she was doing Punky Brewster and then all the nightlife. And then when the show ended, and she recorded everything, and then she put all these tapes in a box. Well, she took them out, hadn't watched them in over 20 years. And she put together, I think, with might be Leonardo DiCaprio. I forget exactly who else is behind this, but put together a very riveting documentary on what it was like being a child star and then everything that she had to go through after the fact. And this isn't the usual, you know, I should say like an E! True Hollywood story where, oh, feel bad for me because nobody likes me anymore because I'm not a Hollywood star. This is about a girl that grew gigantic breasts at the age of 13 and then felt very sexualized by men, like men pulling her and putting her on their laps and things like that. And then she actually got a breast reduction surgery. But it also deals with her group of friends and people like Jonathan Brandis, who was in that movie Ladybugs, if I'm correct, and wound up committing suicide, I think, at 21. But she's got several friends here. I think there were three that committed suicide. There are drug overdoses. And at the end of the day, it's a very sad look at what these kids go through. There are parties, there are drugs, and all that's very attractive at the moment. And the second that ends, it's all very sad. And she seems very grounded. She is still beautiful, like the 45, 46 years old. But This was a very detailed look at something without sensationalizing it or glossing over. And it might have been the truest look at being a teen star. It wasn't like the E! True Hollywood Story where they try to sensationalize it and do all this shit. It was very sad. A lot of it was very sad.
So I just happened to, Barry, as you were telling me, but I pulled it up on the IMDb page, solid 7.0 on the IMDb page. But I think what's interesting is, you know, usually what happens is not the critics review, but they ask people, you know, just ordinary people that watch the movie to give their reviews, and you can post your own reviews on these. So there are five little sort of capsules of reviews. There are, let's see, we have a 3 stars. You have an 8-star, a 10-star, a 9-star saying it's precedent setting, and then a 4-star that says self-indulging and narcissistic. So there are some wildly different viewpoints, but there is one that says if you were a 90s kid or a 90s teen, this will definitely take you back down memory lane.
Yeah, and again, I recommend it. I can see all those points of view. Jeff, sure. Do you have Hulu or no?
Well, it's funny you mention that because the other day, you know, ever since the New Japan show has come on you know, we were looking for our Hulu and Amazon Fire Stick to put it on our TV so I could watch that, whichever is on. And my wife had scoured the house looking for, you know, she goes, I have them together and I know they're somewhere in this house. And I'm like, you know, why don't we just fucking go buy another one, you know, like the attachment for your TV. Of course, that's what we did like many years ago. I don't know if you have to do that anymore if you have a smart television. And so the other day I happened to be going into my nightstand and I open the bottom drawer of my nightstand and I see this bag with all this sort of, you know, wires and stuff. And I hold it up and it says, you know, Hulu and Amazon Fire Stick. I said, honey, you want to come up here? I think I found what we've been looking for. And so, yes, I will soon be availing myself of that New Japan show, which I've been wanting to watch, especially after we interviewed Kevin Kelly recently. And I will be availing myself of the Hulu and maybe checking this movie out too, Bear.
Gotcha. And I got one more for you too.
Okay.
You Cannot Kill David Arquette. So this was one I watched almost immediately
right
after.
There are a few
people
that maybe have thought about it, though, Bear.
But you know what? After watching this, I feel for this guy. So he was put in a position and made world heavyweight champion, and everybody hates him because of that. And they really touch on that throughout the film. At the same token, you know, it wasn't like David Arquette was, you know, petitioning to become world heavyweight champion. This was a business decision that was made, I believe, by Eric Bischoff, you know, the great
Hall of Famer Eric Bischoff.
Yes, exactly. And this is he's the one who should be taking the heat. But when I walked away from this film, I felt sad for David Arquette. He clearly has a lot going on. And he's not this huge, he's a big drinker. I don't know if he's doing drugs, but he's got an issue with alcohol, at least during the filming of this movie. He did. And there are a couple of scenes where he's vomiting because he's drunk. He's drank too much. But he clearly is a guy that has massive anxiety, which he does address, possible mental illness. But he seems like he's got a good heart. And, you know, as you watch this, he just seems like the nicest guy that is just fucked up beyond all belief and all recognition. And I truly felt for him with this. Apparently, he hasn't acted in close to a decade. He can't get hired for anything. And that's why he got back into wrestling. He likes the theatrics of it. But there's a couple of scenes where it appears that wrestlers are taking advantage of him. And one was the Nick Gage incident that occurred, I don't know, a year ago. I forget exactly. But this kind of made some news. And it's where Nick Gage, I think, was jabbing him in the head with a broken fluorescent light tube. And then it cut, I believe, a vein in his neck. And he was squirting out blood. And you know, clearly could have died from this. They had to apply pressure, get him to the hospital, but it's frightening to see because for all intents and purposes, he's really just a layman getting in the ring. It's like if you and I got in the ring and somebody decided to take advantage of us and, you know, and fucking cut our jugular or whatever vein that was. So that was really sad, but I highly recommend this film because if you hate David Arquette, I don't know if you're going to come out with the same emotions after seeing the film.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And then lastly, did you want to talk about that or?
Yeah, let me just, I was just going to tell you, I pulled that page up to 7.2 on the IMDb scale. I will say that of the reviews by people that wrote in, we have a 9, we have a 7, we have a 9, a 9, and a 10 that says powerful, if true, very poignant acting. And another one that says, I'll admit to knowing very little about pro wrestling. So the first thing I'd heard about David Arquette was the scandals and stuff. You know, so very appreciative of the movie. I will say I was certainly not a huge fan of him being in pro wrestling. I did like him in the movie with Drew Barrymore. He played her brother. It was called Never Been Kissed. It was a good romantic comedy. And he was a supporting character in that. And I actually liked him in that role as her brother. He did a good job in that. So I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I never did. And I saw the Scream films and then he did that movie, Eight-Legged Freaks.
Yes. I like that. That was a cute.
Yeah, it was fun. It was stupid, but fun. Good popcorn movie.
Yeah.
Sorry,
God
Jeff.
Bless but, you.
Yeah. God bless me. But I really liked the guy and he, you know, he's very self-effacing. At the end of the movie, he basically says, I'm a really shitty professional wrestler. Like there's no illusions that he thinks he's great. He wants to entertain people. And the fact that he's not making movies or TV, this is kind of his outlet to do it. And promoters see that. But, you know, he has a match. He gets paid and it's a match in the backyard of somebody's house. It's backyard wrestling. And he shows up for that. And they take advantage of him as well. It's just it's very sad. And I definitely hope for the best for the guy because he's a likable guy. But getting back to Hulu, so 5 years ago, I think I went on the greatest binge watching of television that I have ever experienced. And I watched all of American Horror Story over a 2-week period. It literally was like 4 episodes a day or something like that. And I walked away and I was like, that was fucking incredible. And then I said, when I get time, I'm going to watch Sons of Anarchy. It's a show I've always wanted to watch. I never even seen a single episode. Well, Saturday night, right after Svengoolie, I put on my first episode. And happy to say that by 10 o'clock last night, I had finished up the first season. Jeff, have you ever seen Sons of Anarchy?
I have not. And I can tell you before you tell us about your thoughts of Sons
of
Anarchy, I am almost to the end of season 3 of The Wire, which is utterly fantastic. I have to give Brian Lass a shout out because he was the one that kept goading me to watch
it. 2 times in this episode you brought
That's going to mean a pay bump for both of us, I am sure.
Well, in that case, yeah.
And that show is absolutely amazing. And you know, I will say, and this is something that after I watched the first season of The Wire, and I'll let you get back to Sons of Anarchy.
Sure.
Brian told me that one of the things that's interesting is it takes a look at crime. And I know you've seen the show too, Barry. It takes a look at crime from a lot of different points of view. You look at it from the points of view of the drug dealers, from the points of view of the police officers that are trying to deal with the drug dealers, from the point of view of the police department hierarchy, the politicians, you know, everyone and everyone in the court system, and how each of them plays this part in the whole, you know, the chain, you know, like the old Fleetwood Mac song, the chain. There's all links in this chain. And, you know, as I watch the show and here I'm close to the end of season 3, I'm not sure there's anyone in the show that's a true baby face. You know, it's all at best they're tweeners, you know. It's a fantastic show though. And the writing is unbelievable. And some of the acting is just completely spot on. And, I really love it. And it's really great stuff. Now, anyway, so go ahead and talk about Sons of Anarchy.
So Sons of Anarchy, again, I was so excited that when I saw it was on Hulu and they have every season, every episode, I'm like, I'm going to start it tonight. And I was hooked after the first episode. And what they do, which I just think is fantastic, and Sweet Lou and I were talking about this off air earlier, is the character development. In the first episode, they've already developed all the main characters. You already know them. And the storyline is great, but if you don't develop your characters, to me, then you don't actually connect with the show. So I'm riveted. I think if it stays on the pace of what the first season is offered, I think this may be one of the great TV shows of all time. Now, I don't know. It could totally go off the rails in seasons 4, 5, or 6. I have no idea. But I got to tell you, this is fucking mind-blowing television this first season. Everybody's great. Ron Perlman is great. Katie Sagal, who I know Katie Sagal like everybody else from Married with Children.
Sure.
She is... she's evil in a lot of ways. And I don't know if there's a switch or there'd be a baby face turn, but she does some evil shit in this first season. And she's very clever in the way that she does it. But this is my highest recommendation. I haven't felt a connection with a show. This is not a comedy either. So this isn't, like a Stranger Things or a Cobra Kai even. This is a dark show. It's much like Breaking Bad in a sense, and I'm really addicted. But Jeff, if you do need access to Hulu, I'd be more than happy to share.
We'll talk off air.
Gotcha. And the last thing I wanted to bring up today, Jeff. So a report came out this past week where
I know where you're going here. Go ahead.
So the Peacock Network and NBC apparently has been scrubbing a lot of the WWE content, trying to remove racist content. And apparently it's kept them very busy in doing so. So as I was watching or as I was reading this article, I have not subscribed to Peacock yet. It dawned on me, have they had to do this for any of their other content? Other than Seinfeld, which had the Puerto Rican Day Parade episode, which was viewed as racist, and I believe never aired again after its original airing, I couldn't think of anything. And I wonder, did the Peacock Network fully understand what they were getting into? And you would think that they would. We're talking, this is like a multi-million dollar type of deal. Did they have any idea what they were getting into when it came to wrestling and the fact that they would have to be literally removing racist content from their network? The second part of this is a report came out, I believe, this morning that the NBC is, distressed or disturbed at how low the subscription rate for WWE on Peacock has been. I think they expected a lot more.
Yeah, because they're doing that kind of bullshit. That's probably it may not be the total reason, but I'm sure that's part of it, you know?
I think it is too. So I haven't, but what I've heard is a lot of the older content is gone. So if you subscribe to maybe because you wanted to see every Great American Bash, that's no longer on the network. So I don't know what's there and what's not there. But at the same token, you got to realize they're offering the first 4 months of this for $2.50 a month. And there's no commitment time-wise, meaning you can quit anytime you want. So, you know, $2.50, Jeff, I mean, I go to Starbucks and it's like $5 or $6, you know? So
you get the triple mocha cappuccino latte. What do you get there at the old Starbucks?
I get regular coffee and I think it's like between $3 and $4, but at the same time, $2.50, but you're going to get a lot of great NBC shows. But it makes you wonder what's going through the heads of fans who are not subscribing. But Jeff, can you think of any other instance where somebody like NBC or a major network would have to scrub racist content?
Yeah,
it's wrestling. It's
yeah. Wrestling. I have my own thoughts. You buy something that was from a different era, and you're putting the feelings and the mores of people in 2021 on things that were made 50 years ago or, 40 years ago or something like that. And, we always joke and say, oh, it was a different time. It was different,
I just thought of something, Jeff.
Go ahead, lay it on me.
Disney Plus Song of the South. You can't get Song of the South anywhere.
Nope, not at all. Yeah, no. Yeah. It's the same reason why you always hear about groups that want to fucking yank Huckleberry Finn off the shelf. The book was written 150 fucking years ago. Yeah. Guess what? It was a different time and a different age, and it's not one that exists today. But does that mean that you can't appreciate what Mark Twain was writing? It's ridiculous. Oh boy, do I hate fucking censorship. That makes me fucking crazy.
But something like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer also, that was a literal snapshot of the day. You know, it's and granted, look, this is not an excuse for a lot of the behavior that took place or a lot of the verbiage that took place. But at the same time, that existed back then. That was common nomenclature.
Before anyone says anything, I certainly am not comparing Mark Twain to Vince McMahon, the WWE. So I'm sure someone out there is going, "Oh, I can't believe he's comparing Vince." You know, so no.
Yeah.
I'm
Sam just, you know, Clemens will be on Raw tonight. Jeff. Exactly.
Yes, coming out there. So, okay, Barry, as we start heading towards the final turn here, a couple things I wanted to bring out. I reached out as we were making the drive from here in Georgia up to Nashville. I reached out to a friend of the show, Ron Fuller, and I asked him, I said, "Ron, let me ask you a question," because, of course, one of the towns you drive through on the way up there is Chattanooga. And I started thinking about it, and I said, "Wow, I really, you know," of course, Ron recently on the Studcast talked about how you had Jerry Jarrett in Memphis, Nick Gulas in Nashville, and, you know, had Ron Fuller over in Knoxville in the latter part of the 70s. Obviously, when you got into the 80s, 83-ish or something like that, I think Georgia Championship Wrestling had their famous about a 6 or 7 week run in Chattanooga where they had Bill Dundee and Jim Cornette. That was like the first big territory, or I won't say big territory. It was the first territory outside of Memphis that Jim Cornette ever worked. That was where they had the legendary, one of my top 20 moments of the 80s was Jim Cornette's birthday party on Chattanooga wrestling for his dog Fifi. He had a poodle named Fifi.
I remember that. Yes.
Yeah, it was great. It was great stuff. But I reached out to Ron, and my question is, you know, was there ever a circuit that ran Chattanooga? And if so, which circuit was it? And so he responded and said that Nick Gulas and Roy Welch were partners with a guy named Harry Thornton from the 1960s to the 1980s. And I said, "Was it a good town as far as you heard or no?" And he says, "I worked there many times. Nick Gulas ran it on Saturday nights. It was pretty good, especially in the 60s and early 70s. Jim Barnett didn't have much success. Our Continental TV was in there from 85 to 87. Barnett asked us to run it after he had no success and split the profit. We ran one show, sold out, and turned people away. He would not let us run it again," which I thought was pretty funny. So so that answered my question about the history of wrestling in Chattanooga. And now, Barry, let's get to the final question. And it was one where I reached out to a group of people, including Ron Fuller. I didn't get a response back from Ron yet, unfortunately. But what I asked was, I said, if you were coming up with a guy that was a, quote, this is a question I saw on Twitter that my old friend Bill Pankos had answered. Give me a guy who's a perfect mid-carder, okay? In other words, a guy that's never going to, you know, say, I want to be pushed as a main eventer, or you as the booker or promoter are never going to say to yourself, that's a guy that I'm gonna slowly move up the card, and then eventually he's going to be my main event guy, okay? Just a guy that he's going to be working the main events. He's better than like your opening or second match guy, but he's better than just what they used to call a carpenter. He's a guy that's going to give you a good match, going to entertain the fans, going to be a guy the fans know and appreciate, but he's not quite a main eventer. So, Barry, tell me who came to mind for you first. Maybe it was Terry Taylor.
Yeah, so it was Terry Taylor when we were having our discussion earlier, but a couple of names that came up for me. One was Dave Finley, Fit Finley. A guy, you know, I think he's one of the best professional wrestlers of his era, but for whatever reason, never really got that main event push. Perry Saturn is another one. Perry Saturn, until he went off the rails, I thought Perry Saturn could do a lot in the ring. And then
now,
do you mean
Perry Saturn as a singles performer or as part of a tag team?
As a singles performer, I think.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, go ahead.
I think in some ways he was better as a tag team, but I think even as a singles, he was the definition of a guy right in the middle of the card. And the third is a guy that though he got a main event push in certain territories, they were usually smaller territories or territories that maybe, I don't know, but Roger Kirby, a guy from the 70s into the early 80s. Roger Kirby was fantastic, but for whatever reason, when he worked like in Florida, he was mid-card. Tag team, singles, mid-card. Put him in Kansas City, he's main event.
Yeah, and you know, as I asked this question and I reached out to our group of moderators and stuff for our Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, and as I started thinking about it, and I'm going to read their answers, But, you know, a guy that Jim Brunzell mentioned last week, Mike George, okay, a guy that is going to give you a solid match, okay, and a guy, if you put it in this kind of parameters, it's a guy that if you put him in a smaller territory like Kansas City, you can headline a guy with that. You know, he could be a headliner in a small territory, but if he came to like Mid-Atlantic or Mid-South or Florida, it's a guy that is never going to be enough to where you're going to want to put him at the top of the card, but he's never going to embarrass you if you put him in the middle of the card. He's going to give you a good, solid match. The fans are going to appreciate him, but for whatever reason, he just doesn't have what it maybe takes to be, the main event guy. So Mark Hertwick said that he mentioned Bobby Eaton. Now, the only thing I'll say about Bobby Eaton was Bobby Eaton, number one, was a main event guy, as far as I'm concerned, as part of a tag team, as part of a lot of great tag teams. Bobby Eaton, as a single, was a main event guy in Nashville. Again, smaller territory. But Bobby Eaton was good enough. Mark's right. If you, first of all, there's absolutely no problem with putting Bobby Eaton in a singles match in any territory in the country. But if Bobby Eaton had been made a single with a mouth as good as Jim Cornette standing next to him, and really, Bobby, I've seen on interviews, he wasn't horrible, but he wasn't Jim Cornette, and not many people were, Bobby Eaton would have certainly been a very good middle card guy, maybe even higher than that, because he was so good. Another guy that he mentioned was Tito Santana. I think we're getting, with Bobby and Tito Santana, not quite mid-card guys, maybe like more semi-main event guys. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay. And Michael Herrick also agreed with the Bobby Eaton thing. Our old friend Travis John Doe Raines mentioned guys like Sean Waltman, William Regal, Dean Malenko, and Rhino. Steve, what do you think of those choices?
I think give it some thought. It's, I think they all fit the criteria. Rhino is a guy. I think Rhino could have gotten out of the mid card into main events with the right push. Dean Malenko, solid in the ring, small in stature, no personality. That would have been a tough sell out of mid card, I think.
Yeah. So the guys, of course, that I have mentioned many times, a guy like Terry Taylor, we mentioned. Terry Taylor was never, ever going to embarrass the promotion by the way that he wrestled in the ring. He was a great performer. We've talked about it. He held himself back by the attitude and, his mouth outside the ring. If he could have turned that into what happened inside the ring, I bet you he could have got some real heat. He was one of those guys who probably had more heat in the dressing room than he did in the ring. Another guy that I've always talked about was Buddy Landell and Brad Armstrong, two perfect examples of guys that great mid-card guys, smaller promotion. Absolutely, you could have put them at the top of the card. A promotion like, I mentioned Kansas City, a promotion like, say, Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Either guy, perfect at the top of the card. But for a national promotion, more of a kind of guy like a mid-card guy. Another guy that I thought of, just because I was such a mark for wrestling in Japan in the 80s, in all Japan, you had a guy, Masafuchi, who, of course, wrestled over in the United States with Atsushi Onita. Masafuchi was a relatively colorless guy who did a lot of work in six-man tags. I think we talked about one of his six-man tags a few episodes back, Barry, from All Japan. That was such a great match. And Masafuchi is the guy that when you see him, you're like, oh, that's the guy that's probably going to do the job. But in the middle of the card, he's the guy that you're going to put, when a young guy like, say, a Kenta Kobashi was first coming up or Jun Akiyama, you're going to put him in the ring with Masafuchi because the kid's going to learn. And Masafuchi's he's always going to be there for that spot when the kid wants to do his moves or have his spots. He's a guy that I would mention from All Japan, from New Japan in the mid-80s, a guy like Hiro Saito, who is a guy that had a beard and bleach blonde hair, which was very out of character for the Japanese back then. He was a guy that had a little bit of a pot belly, but he could absolutely go in the ring. I think they might have given him the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Championship maybe once for a short run. But a guy that every time I saw that guy, I was like, man, this guy is just completely fucking solid. But he was not a guy they were ever going to put in the main event, with guys like Inoki or Fujinami or anything like that. But middle of the card, he was absolutely perfect, Bear.
Yeah, well, Fuchi was great. I mean, Fuchi was, you watch him, and when we saw him in the U.S., because they were in Florida for a while, and Onita and Fuchi, and we never really saw a whole lot from him. And then you watch some of his stuff, especially when he was older, in his 40s, and my God, I think he was the junior heavyweight champion in All Japan, right?
Yep.
And he was just such a solid worker. That's a great example, though. Fucci, I think, is this is the standard bearer of what you're looking for.
The Masa Fucci Award.
That's it, exactly. That's the guy.
So, okay, just finally, as we start to do the go home, I would like to say, Barry, that we have done more than stick to wrestling. Boom, I had to get the McAdam reference in. It's late in the show. People thought I was going to forget. I did not forget, Barry. So I would encourage you to follow me. I haven't done this in a while, Barry, on Twitter, at Baudrin Jeff. I encourage you to follow me. Breaking Gay Fabe with Baudrin and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Any last thoughts, Lord Barons?
Now, fun episode. I think we were texting yesterday. We're like, we don't really have a lot of content. And here we are, like,
I thought we'd have maybe 30 minutes worth of content. And we started rambling on, and we've hit our mark. And I'm proud of you and I, Bear, and as well as Lisa.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. So, so on behalf of Barry Rose, my co-host, and our producer, the sweet man, Luke Kippelman, we will see you next week. Out.